You're listening to the podcast for Inforum, an innovation lab at the Commonwealth Club. Buy tickets to upcoming live events in San Francisco at inforumsf.org. Want even more Inforum? Find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram as InforumSF. It is now my absolute pleasure to introduce Eric Liu and Abdi Soltani to you here at Inforum.
Good evening. I'm Abdi Soltani. I'm the executive director of the ACLU of Northern California, and I'm delighted. Thank you. And I'm delighted tonight to be in conversation with Eric Liu, who is the author of this wonderful book, You're More Powerful Than You Think, which I've had the pleasure of reading over the past week, including while I was at the beach in Santa Cruz and finishing last night, and I just love the book, and I'm so excited to have this chance to talk with you. Eric is a really accomplished leader in the area of civic participation, government, and public policy, including as a former speechwriter for President Clinton and as deputy domestic advisor for President Clinton, and also leading Citizen University. So please welcome Eric Liu.
Thank you.
So I really enjoyed reading this book, and I really, truly, genuinely recommend it to everybody who is here and listening if you haven't had a chance yet to read it. And today we're just going to get into it, and I don't think this conversation can replace reading the book. That's my point. So let's get started.
He's paid on commission.
Yeah, exactly. So I actually, what's great about the book is it has all these blank pages at the back, so all my notes are right here. So there's a part in the book you talk about power, and that part of the book is from the page one to the end of the book. So I'd like to just begin with just what's your definition of power?
Well, Abdi, first of all, thank you for joining me in conversation today, and thanks to the Commonwealth Club and all of you for coming out tonight. This is great energy, and looking forward to a great conversation tonight. I think it's worth taking a step back a moment. So I run a nonprofit called Citizen University. This book and our work is all about citizen power, and it is worth unpacking, actually, what I mean when I say those words, citizen power. So let me start with citizen. When I talk about citizen in this context and Citizen University, I'm not talking about documentation status under the immigration and naturalization laws of the United States. I'm talking about a deeper ethical conception of being a member of the body, a contributor to community, a pro-social contributor to community. In a word, I'm talking about being a non-sociopath. It's worth saying that these days. That's what I mean by citizen. And I think it's important to say that for many obvious kind of human reasons, but it's also important to remember that there are so many people in our country today who have the documents but do not live like citizens. And there are so many others who lack the documents but do, right? And so number one, that's what I mean there. When I talk about power, I define power simply as a capacity to ensure that others do as you would have them do. Right? Now, for a lot of folks, that's a little bit like, ooh, that's menacing sounding. That sounds kind of domineering and almost evil, right? Conjures up Game of Thrones, House of Cards, kind of pick your dark power fantasy show, right? And I understand that, but I think that in general, and in particular in this moment right now in American history, if you have qualms and misgivings about candidly naming and identifying and looking squarely at power, then this is the time to get over it, right? This is the time for us to get very comfortable naming and identifying power, not only as it flows all around us, but as it flows through us, and recognizing that this is not to talk about power this way is not a partisan thing. It is not a thing that means that power is inherently evil. It means simply that as humans, we are always trying in every circle of relationship to ensure that others do as we would like them to do, right? And we will do that through all different kinds of conduits, using all different kinds of means and methods, whether it's ideas or force or numbers or social norms. But in all these contexts, if we are willfully ignorant about what we are doing, what we mean when we talk about power, well, that only plays into the hands of those who are very happy to exploit our ignorance, mm-hmm. right? And I think it's really important right now just for us to define terms and name it and unpack it in this way. We, in American life, particularly, frankly, among progressives, we euphemize power. We talk about voice, right? We talk about presence. We talk about strength, right? But voice is a predecessor to or a predicate of power, but voice isn't power by itself, right? Naming power and being able and willing to do that is, I think, one of the first responsibilities of citizenship in that broader, more capacious sense that I named.
So you talk about power and you talked about House of Cards, and I watched like one whole season and then I just couldn't do it anymore.
That's more than I did.
After the election, I was just like, oh, no, it's just too much. It's just too much. But you also talked about how, you know, we're not dealing with the West Wing right now. You know, the TV show has kind of a more cynical view of power. And you also had this great line in the book where you said, Mr. Smith died in Washington. I was like, oh, Eric, that's just wrong. You know? So you talk about cynicism, and that cynicism is in some ways the greatest threat to democracy. And I'm just interested in your perspectives, you know, especially right now, you know, coming out of the murder in Charlottesville and neo-Nazis and Klan and white supremacists coming out in such full force with violence. Just how do you guard against cynicism? And how do you refresh your participation and your energy in this kind of context that we're in?
Well, I guess I would say a couple of things. You know, first of all, the way the country has responded to Charlottesville is, to me, proof positive that we are overcoming cynicism, right? We did not look as a people at Charlottesville and say, well, what can I do? I guess it's the time for neo-Nazis to surge. I guess this is going to be their era, right? That was not the response of most Americans. And I'm not just talking about on the left. I mean, I think across the political spectrum and among people who, frankly, don't think much about partisanship or politics in everyday life, but who are part of this, yeah, part of the problem in that they are perhaps ignorant about politics, but part of the solution in that they have a core of decency that has been activated in this moment, right? And so I think the response to Charlottesville reminds me of the response in this country after the Muslim travel ban was issued. Which was spontaneous, unplanned, uncoordinated swarming of citizens to airports, to train stations, to places to protect the disfavored, right? We were like antibodies to a virus, right? The system kind of, the immune system of the body politic was beginning to respond then, right? And I think that's been happening a lot more. So I do think that that's a relatively positive thing. If you look at what happened in Boston last weekend, right? And frankly, I was one of the folks going into Boston of the view, and it may be the case here in San Francisco with what's planned this weekend at Chrissy Field, these folks feed on the oxygen of our attention. And so far better to not go where they are and to create our own rallies and our own gatherings and our own affirmative affirmations of what we stand for than to recreate Charlottesville. Boston kind of is a rebuttal to that notion, right? If you get overwhelming force and numbers and you have 30,000 people to counter the, whatever it was, under 200 people there, that's a positive thing. But again, this is a measure of how we are actually busting through many decades worth now of encrusted cynicism. And I think this is the point that is worth saying that is kind of the step before your question. Right, it just will do no good for us to go around to folks and say, "Hey, be less cynical. Come on, be more idealistic." Right, that's a hard sell. Right, people, to the extent people are cynical right now in American civic life, it's for good reason. Mm-hmm. It's because we've had three or four decades of grinding, relentless inequality. We've had concentration of wealth, concentration of clout and voice in this country. Right, and it's been this slow motion tectonic kind of shifting of plates that has been crushing people in between them, right? And so there's pretty good reason for people, whether you are a Bernie Sanders supporter or a Donald Trump supporter, to agree with the proposition last fall that the game has been rigged, Because the game has been rigged, right? Our economic policy, our tax expenditure policy, all of which is kind of flipped upside down to reward the affluent, the already affluent, for being affluent, mm-hmm. right? And so there is cause for cynicism, but I think what is most poisonous to democracy, to self-government, isn't even apathy or bitterness or anger or rage. It is cynicism in the sense of just thinking, well, the game is so rigged, there's no point in my getting involved, mm-hmm. right? Thank God we are not there. And actually, I will say, the folks who did show up and cast their ballots for Donald Trump are also part of, in the long scheme of things, the solution. They were part of the corrective here of people saying the game has been rigged, but we're not going to take it anymore, right? Now, their remedy is not the remedy I would have chosen or prescribed, but the fact that they chose, in fact, to continue to show up is a measure of how I think this period right now is forcing us to confront the ways in which over a couple of generations now, we have been in our economic and social policies betraying the American principles, and people are ready to reclaim them.
Yeah. You talk in the book about three laws of power, and I want to just take them each one at a time.
Yeah.
Because this relates exactly to where you were going about concentration. Mm-hmm. And your first law of power is that power concentrates and that it forms a monopoly. How did you come to that observation? Did you come to that from seeing it from the view of someone who was in government? Or is that something that crystallized for you when you were outside of the government and trying to kind of come at it from the outside?
That's a very interesting question. You know, I think it's, having left Washington, D.C. 17 years ago and moved out to Seattle, where I live and have been ever since, is, as you all know, being here, a really great, it gives you a great perspective on what is broken in the Beltway, right? And what is broken in kind of traditional national politics. But I think what led me to this notion that law number one of civic power is that power concentrates and it compounds and it tends to kind of cluster that the rich get richer, but also that disadvantage and powerlessness also compound, right? That the poor get poorer. There was no aha moment. It's just literally being awake for the last 30 years, mm-hmm. right? And I think what particularly awakened me was several years back when the combination of the emergence of the Tea Party and the emergence of Occupy Wall Street made folks realize in ways that I think we still lack a full vocabulary for, that there was a great pushback underway, mm-hmm. that did not fit easily into a left-right, Democrat, Republican, liberal-conservative set of boxes, but it was a great pushback against concentrated, monopolized power, right? Now, for folks on the left, a lot of their complaint is about concentrated economic power in the hands of Wall Street, in the hands of major global corporations. On the right, maybe that fear is more about concentrated state power and crony capitalism in a way that blends with government to kind of rig games for favored folks. But whichever flavor you have of hating monopoly, we are in an age in which people are hating monopoly, right? And I think that is one of the things that is particularly pertinent about our time. But this is a universal law, right? The idea that power compounds and it concentrates is as old as scripture. It's as old as Machiavelli. It's as old as human nature, right? And you see it today in ways that aren't even about politics, but are very heightened, again, here in the Bay Area, heightened in tech and Silicon Valley, right? Both in terms of the ways in which this town and this region are evidence of how a few are getting most of the rewards, right, of the tech economy, but also in the ways in which the very platforms and technologies of this era are ones that in which initial advantages compound, right? So algorithmically, who gets likes on Facebook? Folks who already got likes on Facebook, right? That's the nature of things, right? That's how things feed. And you see that, and you see how things get viral and followers accumulate. And so it's a very interesting experiment that we're running on social media to make visible to a lot of people one of the more invisible dynamics of human life.
So your second law of power is the idea that power justifies itself. And here you kind of switched a little bit from the mechanics of power to the ideology and the ideas that undergird power and that are used to justify it. And you gave a number of examples, but I'd love to hear about some of the ways that you've seen people counter those ideas. And your book talks about a number of them, but I'd love for you to share
Yeah.
One of the ways people chip at that ideology and break it apart.
Yeah. So just to unpack this second law, if law number one is that power compounds and concentrates, law number two is that power justifies itself, right? At every turn, incumbent holders of power, whether they're individuals or institutions, will spin elaborate narratives about why God meant it for it to be that way, right? Or why that is the way of nature, or the way of the world, right? And there are a variety of flavors of this, right? In economics, you can boil this down to what we think of as trickle-down economics, right? The idea that the super wealthy are quote-unquote job creators, and we must worship and cherish those job creators and coddle them and treat them nicely and not hurt them with the tax code and not be mean to them so that perhaps their prosperity will leak its way down to everybody else, right? Now, that's a nice little fable.
I love the use of the word leak there.
Yeah.
It's like, like, really?
It might not be what's her name? I forget her name, the wife of the current Treasury Secretary, might have posted on Instagram, but it is that ideology, right? I'm a rich job creator, so you should be grateful to me for letting some of my prosperity make its way down to you. Like I say, it's a good fable. There's no actual basis in economic fact for it, but it is a classic example of how, well, it's a story of divine right is what it boils down to, right? In just the way that kings and emperors used to tell us, hey, man, I'm the son of God. Back off, right? We have an economic royalism right now in trickle-down economics. But here's another one that goes back to Charlottesville, white supremacy. Okay, now I'm not talking, it's the easy case is to say I'm against Nazis. I am against Nazis, right? I'm against kind of violent white supremacists of the sort who we saw in Charlottesville. But to actually unpack the narrative of white supremacy is to go much deeper than that. Right? It is to look at all our institutions, whether it's the Commonwealth Club, whether it's our workplaces, whether it's our universities, whether it's how housing gets allocated in a community, whether it's how policing happens in a city or a community, and ask yourself, in which ways do these institutions have a baseline default preference and setting for whiteness? In which ways do these institutions, by default, penalize non-whiteness? In which ways do these institutions silently, often in unacknowledged ways, perpetuate the unearned advantages of whiteness, right? And we do that in a variety of ways. So this idea that Confederate monuments are about heritage and, you know, Confederate monuments are monuments to white supremacy. They are monuments to disunion. They are monuments to the enemies of the idea of the United States, right? But they are part of a narrative of self-justification, right? And so power is always justifying itself. And I think some of the most effective ways in which, to your question, that different citizen activists around the country have been busting apart this kind of these narratives of self-justification. You can draw examples, as I do in the book, from both the left and the right. Actually, one of the examples from the right is a very interesting one from a guy who has his roots in Northern California, a guy named Mark Meckler, who's a friend of mine, who was one of the founders of the Tea Party Patriots. When that organization first emerged, and when it, in its early days, it truly was a grassroots organization of people semi-spontaneously joining massive conference calls and deciding they wanted to organize and push back against what they felt was this drift and concentration of power in the hands of the federal government in the response to the financial crisis, right? What Mark Meckler did when he founded the Tea Party, and eventually he quit the Tea Party Patriots because he felt it had gotten co-opted by the Republican Party. But what he's done since he quit the Tea Party is create a different project called the Convention of States. Have any of you heard of this? Okay, maybe one or two of you have heard of this. So this is a constitutional issue, right? Article 5 of the Constitution gives us the power to call a constitutional convention anytime we want, if we can get enough states to agree to a resolution calling for such a convention, right? So Mark Meckler and his compatriots at an organization called Citizens for Self-Governance have in fact decided to organize people in states around the country to try to pass resolutions, to try to get enough states to actually call a constitutional convention. Their goal for the convention is to rein in and restrict overweening federal power, right? Which to my mind is quite an overbroad mission statement for the Constitutional Convention, and will certainly, if they ever succeeded in calling one, it would probably become a circus. But forget about the practicality of it. This is a great little example of them taking a narrative of how the Constitution, grabbing hold of a narrative of the Constitution and of our origins as a country in fighting against concentrated monopolized power, and saying, we stand for this now, right? That the federal government now is the thing that actually has to be pushed back against, right? Now, again, I don't agree with that point of view. I don't agree with the particulars of what they're doing.
But you are promoting it.
But I am promoting it, if for no reason, no other reason than for you to know about it, right? There are millions of your fellow citizens who are trying to organize a constitutional convention right now. You ought to know about that, right? And I think one of the things that is interesting is that they've been very effective at thinking about how you flip these narratives of self-justification and the narratives that come out of Washington, D.C. about how elites and establishments know best. And they are tapping into, again, a different narrative that plenty of folks on the left in California can buy into, which is local wisdom is the greatest. Local knowledge is the strongest. Local power is the most honest. Local force is the most accountable, right? There are a lot of people in this room who can nod their head at that litany of statements. And they're trying to tap into that and flip this narrative to say, we are the future of local power. We are the future of local citizen action. And again, you can quarrel with them and, you know, look under the hood and see who's behind them and so forth and find things that'll trouble you. But it's a very interesting example of...
Eric, I want to come back to this local federal piece in a moment.
Yeah.
But let's go to your third law of power. Mm-hmm. And this one just was my favorite of your three laws. And you said that power is infinite and that new power can be created out of thin air. And I thought that was a really interesting insight and one that I want you to take a moment.
Did you believe it at first? Did you read it and think, oh, come on, that's a...
I think that... Well, let me tell you where I was going to go, so yeah. Now I'm going to come right back. I've always thought of power as a zero-sum game.
Yeah.
There's 100 seats in the United States Senate. There's 9 seats on the Supreme Court. 9, right? I should know this stuff.
Yeah, you forget, like, because broadcast. The Gorsuch seat was...
Yeah, it was like 8, and then 7, and then 9. Okay. You know, there's 435, is it, seats in the House of Representatives, 50 governor seats. So I've always thought of power as this zero-sum game where you're fighting for securing X preferences represented in your government. I'm not a partisan person. I've never been involved in partisan politics, but I've always thought of power as a zero-sum game because those manifestations of power in government are limited in number, unless we, like, subdivide our cities and subdivide the Senate and so on. But your insight that power can be created out of thin air and that it's infinite really run completely counter to, like, the wiring of my brain, and I found it really inspiring. So I'd love to hear, again, like, how did you come to that insight?
Yeah.
Again, was it cumulative? Was there a moment that it hit you? Because I did think that was a really fresh perspective that was in your book.
Well, let me say, I mean, in your questions about when did I learn it, it's partly, like I said earlier, about being awake and alive right now in this time. But also our work at Citizen University, you know, all our work is about democratizing understanding of how power works in civic life, which means we work with and play with this incredibly wide array of citizen activists and organizers from right, left, center, and points kind of orthogonal to that axis, right? And, you know, this third law is, I really want to underscore something that's really important about it. Because laws 1 and 2, that power concentrates into these, you know, monopolized situations, and that power always justifies itself. If we stop right there, that's a pretty grim situation, right? You're just stuck in this doom loop in which a few people get everything and tell you why you should be happy about it, right? what breaks us out of that doom loop is law number 3, which is that power is infinite, that you can generate new power out of thin air, and you do that through this magic act called organizing, right? By organizing 1 or 100 or 1,000 other humans to engage on a common cause and identify common objectives and common strategies and create common narratives, you are generating power where it did not previously exist, right? And your intuitions are understandable and on a certain level correct. You know, there are institutions like the Senate or the Congress where there is a finite number of seats, right? But I would say this. There is, beyond those institutions, an infinite ecosystem that shapes those institutions. There is no hard cap on the number of movements that can arise to unwind the criminal industrial complex, the prison industrial complex, right? There is no hard cap on the number of seats available to us to spread the notion that Black Lives Matter, right? There's no hard cap on the number of seats for us available to change the storyline about our friends who are dreamers and undocumented friends, neighbors, coworkers, family members, right? That our capacity actually to shift the frame of the possible in politics is available to us simply by organizing. And again, this age that we're in, whether you're talking about the Dreamers, Black Lives Matter, Tea Party, $15 now, Occupy Wall Street, folks across the spectrum are living proof of the infinitude of power, right? And our intuitions come oftentimes not only from this kind of, when I talked about the inequality that we're in, this age of inequality, what does inequality breed? It breeds fear. It breeds a scarcity mentality, right? And it makes everybody start looking over their shoulder and everybody worrying about whether someone's getting ahead of them, right? Because we're not all prospering together, right? And so in that kind of age, it's very natural to default to these zero-sum mindsets, to this idea that power is finite. And it's also an intuition from physics, right? In physics, you know, the laws of thermodynamics tell us that if someone in this room is going to get more heat or energy, someone else in this room has to get less because we're a closed system, right? And there's conservation of energy. But I'm not talking about physics. I'm talking about civics, right? And in civics, you can completely generate new power that didn't exist before. Now, that doesn't mean that you can be infinitely rich or infinitely mighty or infinitely strong, right? But by creating new power where it didn't exist, what you've set in motion now is a dynamic in which others will do the same. Others who are opposed to you will also realize, oh yeah, we too can organize, and we too can generate countervailing power against your countervailing power, right? There's a word for this process, politics, right? this is what it's supposed to be like in a democratic society where we are always trying to organize and counter-organize and counter-organize the counter-organizers, right? And I think that reality that power is infinite is all around us right now in a way that I think is super exciting because it means lots of people are breaking out of that finite zero-sum mentality, right? And I think, again, I actually give, unintended credit to the current occupant of the White House because he alone, as he has liked to say, he alone is responsible for the greatest surge of civic participation and engagement that we've seen in this country in half a century, right? It's been 50 years since you've seen people show up and get involved and wake up and get off the sidelines like this, yeah. Right? And all these millions of people who are showing up at marches, who are writing their members of Congress, who are running for office, who are learning about their school boards, who are understanding the nuances of policy, whether local policy or the emoluments clause of the Constitution, all these folks are generating brand new power where it didn't exist previously, yeah. Right? That's our moment.
I think that after I read that section of your book, then I reflected on what you were saying, and I think the fact that we go from inauguration to the Women's March, the largest demonstrations in American history, the fact that we, as you mentioned, go from the executive order on the Muslim ban to tens of thousands of Americans rallying at airports while attorneys go to court. Mm-hmm. And then again, like coming back around to Virginia, you know, going from the most horrific recent memory that I have of the torchlit march through the university and then the killing and murder of Heather Heyer to then without the use of social media, just through text messages and phone calls, people organizing a 5,000 person candlelight gathering on that campus. Each of these was the creation of power out of thin air that I really kind of, it stayed with me. I think when I, each book that I read, you know, it starts to fade after some time, but there's something in it that stays with you. And this idea that we can create power out of thin air is one of the things that'll stay with me. Mm. There's another thing in your book that'll stay with me, which were two words followed by a question mark. And later, when we get to questions, you don't need to keep your questions just to two words. I'm told you can go to 20. but my point is to say that a really good question can be awfully short. And your question was, who decides?
You're listening to a podcast of Inforum, an innovation lab at the Commonwealth Club. Support our podcast and find out about upcoming live events in San Francisco at inforumsf.org.
That is the all of civic power can be boiled down to those two words. Who decides? Right? I don't care what arena you're looking at. Who decides this ought to be the textbook on American history in Texas? Who decides that California should or shouldn't have light rail? Right, high-speed rail. Who decides whether the United States participates in the Paris Climate Accord? Right? Who decides on whether it is going to be okay for these Patriot Prayer folks to have a rally on federal land on Saturday? Right? The reality of our time right now is that it's twofold. Number one, we are paying the price for a few decades of declining civic literacy, right? Let me put it this way. Too many of us are illiterate in power, right? Too many of us, you know, have feelings and opinions about issues, but have pretty much no clue how you would actually change something, right? Have pretty much no idea what the conduits and the power structure and the decision-making pathway is on any number of these issues. And I don't mean just public policy issues in which legislation or regulation are at issue. I mean also, like, who decided that gay marriage was okay? Okay, you could say at the end of the day the United States Supreme Court said it, but you might also say, well, at a certain point, Gavin Newsom said it, right? But then you might also say at a certain point before that, Barney Frank said it. Or you might also say that before that, folks at Stonewall said it. Or, you know, like, who decides, right? We are participants in this decision, particularly on things like social norms, that don't have a single body or entity of decision-making, right? But we are shapers of the, I'll use this phrase again, the frame of the possible, what we think of as normal and okay, right? And this is the menace and the danger that both the neo-Nazis pose and that those like the president who have coddled them pose, right? It is a threat to norms. It is a permission giving to unwind norms that had ruled that out of bounds previously, right? But we are the deciders of that, right? And I think this illiteracy in civic power, in understanding not only how a bill becomes a law, which many people don't actually know, but also, you know, not really having a good sense of the kind of fuzzier stuff of how a hashtag becomes a movement, how an opinion becomes conventional wisdom, right? And again, here we are in the capital of tech and social media and kind of disruptive network technologies. If you all aren't literate in that, who on earth is going to be, right? And so this is an opportunity and an obligation for us right now to think about how we are not just observers of the deciders, but we become the deciders in different ways, right? And I think that is a thing that, though a lot of our conversation today is focused on national politics, I actually think is practiced best at home, right? All citizenship is local. And how you engage on questions of local choice-making, local preference-making, whether it's economic, social, you know, safety, whatever it is the best way to kind of rebuild that. You know, my friend Annie Leonard, who's here in the Bay Area, who runs Greenpeace USA, has always talked about how Americans have these hugely overdeveloped consumer muscles and these pitifully atrophied citizen muscles, right? And that is the reality of life. But I think this is a time for us to start practicing the citizen muscle. And I think the best arena to do that is the local. Because at the local, you oftentimes will literally know who decides, like know them personally, or be 1 or 2 degrees removed from them. But then you can also see and feel the impact of change, action, resistance in a way that is a bit more kind of diffuse and too filtered at the level of federal and national politics.
Your book begins with talking about what is power and the rules of power. And then the middle section is really a set of guides about strategy that we won't have the time to get into. And I want to leave like a bit of teasers for everybody to go and get the book and read it. But I want to pick up on one of the things that you talk about, which is changing the game and adjusting the arena. Mm-hmm. And I love the metaphor of adjusting the arena. And it's an idea that I've had, and I've tried to talk to my coworkers, and you gave it a vocabulary, which I liked a lot. And the thing that I thought about is in the work that I'm doing on addressing mass incarceration in the criminal justice system, there's an arena which our whole sector has pretty much kind of hung back from,
And yet it's the arena in which we have the greatest voice, and that is the power we have over our elected county prosecutors, the district attorney, that's really central to it. So I really appreciate the idea of adjusting the arena. But I want to go back to the local federal aspect. When Eric and I were in the green room, we were talking about the Constitution. Mine has gotten a little tattered because I've had to use it a lot more and check it daily. But, you know, the 14th Amendment, you said it's your favorite amendment. And that is one of the post-Civil War amendments that requires equal protection under the law. And it says that the states are required to provide equal protection. And in for the civil rights movement, we have often turned to the federal government to come down on the side of civil rights and equality, where the states were often, you know, whether it's through the Confederacy or through any number of other arenas, really, you know, the force of inequality, while the federal government has also been that force too. Mm-hmm. But I'd like to get your perspectives on right now. Mm-hmm. You know, we have who we have in the federal government. States are very different between a state like California or a state like Texas. And then cities, regardless of state, tend to be concentrated with more liberal voters, more voters of color, and the like. So for those of us, as we as citizens, make choices about which arena to fight in, what's your advice to us about where do we concentrate our energy? I'm kind of switching from the framework of your book to asking your actual advice right now.
Yeah. Yeah. So first of all, if you have a pocket constitution and it's gotten all kind of tattered and you know, water stained here, get the Constitution app. it doesn't crumble. And I think it's worth, I know many of you in this room know the 14th Amendment, but it is my favorite amendment because of Section 1, right? All persons born or naturalized in the United States or subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. Right? What I just read to you is the second Constitution. What I just read to you is what this country did after the Civil War to say, we're going to fix what was broken in the original Constitution. And we're going to hold the protections of the Bill of Rights not only to hold the federal government to those protections, but actually we're going to hold the states, because we learned in the Civil War that the states can be great actors of malevolence and that the states need to be curbed, right? So to your question about our time right now, I think we're in a very interesting time where there are more and more opportunities and calls for what I think of as both progressive federalism, which is to say, let's let the states be engines of innovation and engines of experimentation, but also even beyond that, what I call network localism. Let's let webs of cities be the real laboratories of democracy right now. Right? Let me put it another way. I'm not waiting on the federal government, and this was true even under the prior administration. I'm not waiting for the federal government to be the vanguard of civic innovation. Right? I supported the previous president. I voted for, I worked for, you know, in different ways, Barack Obama. But in Washington State, where I live, on two big issues that I care about, we couldn't wait for the United States Congress to take action. Right? We organized, a group of friends and I organized our fellow citizens in the state of Washington to enact background checks for gun purchases. And we did that through a vote of the people. Right? And then we, a similar, somewhat overlapping group of citizens, organized to push forward a $15 minimum wage, first in SeaTac and then in Seattle, right? And we set in motion a cascade. We set in motion a contagion, right? And $15, the $15 minimum wage is actually a pretty good example of what's possible in this age, as are gun responsibility laws, right? That you can bypass a broken, stuck Congress by going to networks and webs of states and cities. And so I think this is a time where We have to have more of that experimentation. Now, it's interesting because roles are reversing right now, right? What I've just said about let there be local experimentation, let the federal government stay out of the way, sounds like what you used to think of as conservative rhetoric, right? It's sort of Reaganite rhetoric. But the reality is that there is an opportunity for progressive federalism of this way. And the roles have flipped the other way, that there are now folks, at least at the state level, in states like Missouri. So St. Louis passes an increased minimum wage. And then the Missouri legislature says, no, we will preempt you, mm-hmm. right? Because the city is a creature of the state and we can shut you down, right? So now they're all for top-down big government trampling on what local citizens want to do, right? Yeah. Now they're all for kind of the heavy hand of the state stifling what experimentation is going to happen from the bottom up, right? So roles are reversing. And, you win debating points, but you don't do any good long-term to kind of point that out, right? The reality is that we've just got to keep on innovating, right? San Francisco and the Bay Area are fonts of that kind of innovation on all kinds of policy, whether it's wages, whether it's protections for workers and worker organizing, whether it's marriage equality, you name it, right? We've got to now not do this in isolation. Seattle has to web up with San Francisco, but also web up with Wichita, has to web up with Akron, has to web up with Pittsburgh, has to web up with Tampa, right? And to get activists and active citizens in all these places to create, what I think of as an archipelago of policy innovation, right? That transcends kind of state borders. And look, the reaction to Trump pulling us out of the Paris Climate Accords is a good example, right? So Trump, who decides? Trump can decide that the United States government will not accede to the Paris Accords, but we decide whether our cities, our corporations, our nonprofit organizations, our universities are all going to voluntarily say, we continue to raise our hand to commit to living up to these climate standards, right? Nobody's stopping us from networking up and doing that. And I think that is going to be the wave of the future. And again, for us as awakened citizens, it means being able to see in systems, right? And learning how to think in networks this way. When you were talking a moment ago, Abdi, about adjusting the arena, mm-hmm. I want to unpack that a bit because I think it's really important. Those three laws we talked about earlier yield three imperatives for action, right? If law number one is that power concentrates into these monopolized winner-take-all games, our first imperative is to change the game. Just as we did in Washington State when we bypassed an NRA-controlled legislature and went to the people on our background checks measure, right? If in the second place, power is always justifying itself with these narratives of why it is so, then our imperative in the second place is to change the story, right? As we did with the $15 minimum wage, right? What we did in the $15 minimum wage was to leave behind the old strategy of saying, you got to raise the wage for poor people because it's not nice to have such low wages, right? A compassion-based argument, a niceness-based argument will only take you so far, right? What we countered trickle-down economics with in the case of $15 in Seattle was an argument that redefined the origins of prosperity. And we said, actually, prosperity doesn't trickle down from a few to the rest of us. True, sustained prosperity emerges from the bottom up and the middle out. Because when workers have more money in their pockets, businesses have more customers, right? And that sets in motion a positive feedback loop of increasing demand in which we are all better off when we're all better off, right? That was changing the story, right? That was not just accepting the prior story that said, oh, if you raise wages, the boss is going to have to lay off somebody, right? Because it's a zero-sum game. I'd hate to have to lay you off, so you better just accept your, slavery wages, right? No, we're changing the story about where prosperity comes from. And then finally, this idea of change the equation. If people are stuck in this mindset that power is finite and zero sum, you've got to remind them that actually power is positive sum. You can create new power out of thin air, right? And all these movements we've been talking about here are evidence of that. So the adjusting of the arena is this very simple case of, how on computers when you're cropping a photo, right, and you get to kind of decide how big or small you're going to make it, right? I mean, that's just that. This is what's happening in politics all the time, right? The fight on gun reform in Washington State, we had, when the arena was just the Washington State legislature, that was an arena that was designed to benefit the gun lobby. Because all the gun lobby had to do was to own and pick off, 4, 5 moderate Democrats, right? It was Democrats who killed this legislation in our legislature, not Republicans, right? All they had to do was own four or five moderate Democrats, and they could bottle up legislation forever. And we tried initially to kind of push it and force it through that rigged game. But when we failed, we realized, actually, the thing to do is expand the arena, size it up this way, right? When you go to a vote of the people in a state where public opinion polls show that the people are for responsible common sense measures, then you bypass that rigged closed insider game, right? You play the outside game. And politics is this continuous readjusting, right? And I don't mean to say, sometimes the progressive thing is to expand the arena. Sometimes the progressive thing is to narrow the arena, right? But in all cases, you have to be conscious that the arena is itself sizable, right? And that we can actually shift the parameters.
Yeah. Eric, you towards the end of the book, you speak about that you wrote, when you wrote this book, you didn't speak so much about leaders and leadership. And there's, you know, dozens of books about leadership. You chose to write about citizens and citizenship. So as we now kind of think about this question, what I love about that is that your book is all about leadership, but you framed it in terms of citizens and all of us, each of us, and what we can do to participate, which I love. So I think we're now ready to turn to the audience for question and answer, and you can start to line up. I'm wondering where folks, where's the microphone?
There's a microphone in the
back. Oh, in the back. Okay.
Yep.
So folks can start to line up. And while you're lining up, you know, sometimes in work and life and the things we're involved in, you suddenly get put next to someone who you realize is truly your kindred spirit. So I've been going around reading the 14th Amendment for months, and the 14th Amendment talks about every person born here as a citizen. And my parents came to the United States on a six-month fellowship in 1973. They lost track of time. When they went to the doctor for a checkup before my mom would fly back to Iran, the doctor said, "I'm so sorry. You're too far in this pregnancy to fly back. This child will be born in the United States." And so in the book, you talk about connecting our stories. And I realized that my story of citizenship is tied to the story of the ending of slavery and the second constitution.
Yes.
And that to me was a revelation. And then from there I go to the question of then what is my, if that's the origin of my citizenship, then what's my responsibility as a citizen? Mm. So I really appreciate that you are an evangelist for the 14th Amendment.
Constitution nerds unite.
Yeah. So let's go to the first person who's lined up for a question. And again, if you could keep your questions, you don't need to have it to be two words like "who decides," but if you could keep your questions brief, we'd appreciate it.
Is this on? Yes. Hi, my name is Judy Levy. I'm here from Maui.
Wow.
And my son lives here in Berkeley and is the director of Generation Citizen. And I hope to model all his life that it's really, to me, it's about local up. On Maui, a couple of years ago, we led a citizens initiative. We got 21,000 signatures. We got an initiative on our ballot because we have Monsanto headquartered there, who is trying to control our food source. And we don't like it. And they're not even growing food. They're growing genetically modified seeds. So I guess I want to take back some hope because I'm involved in the Shaka movement, which is sustainable Hawaiian agriculture for the keiki, the children, and the aina, the land. And I think this whole sustainability movement, and it's thrilling to drive around San Francisco and see all the organic places. Yeah. So give me some more hope so we can keep going and fight this dragon of...
Yeah.
Okay.
So
okay?
Two things. Wait, did you say your... what is your name again?
Judy Levy. I live on Maui.
Okay. And is your
My son is David Morin, who's director of Generation Fantastic. Citizen, and they're doing great work
okay.
getting our
okay,
next...
So let's go to Eric's answer.
So the reason why I asked the question is there are two little points of hope I would give. One of them is in your family. So Generation Citizen, for those of you who don't know, is part of a burgeoning movement in this country called Action Civics in K-12 schools, teaching civics by having kids do it, right? Another pioneering organization that's doing this stuff originated out of Chicago is called the Mikveh Challenge, named after former federal judge and congressman and White House counsel Abner Mikveh. And what they do is they get kids, Generation Citizens in New England mainly, and Mikveh is in Chicago, L.A., and D.C., They get kids to identify a problem that they would like to address, right? It might be street violence in Chicago. It might be food deserts in D.C. It might be poor mass transit in Los Angeles. And then their assignment basically is fix it, or at least learn how you would fix it and figure out who decides, right? And figure out after you read the map of power and understand how you draw that map of who decides, then figure out, in addition to how to read power, how would you write power? How would you mobilize people, money, ideas, opinion, social norms to apply pressure on the right points in that map of power conduits to change the game, right? The fact that this is happening more and more now with young people after many decades of declining civic education is one point of hope that I have, because you got to think generationally about this, right? The second point of hope I have actually is I open the book with a story that some of you probably heard of the tomato pickers of Immokalee. So Immokalee, Florida, in southwest Florida, is the location where most of the United States tomato crop gets grown and picked. And for most of the 20th century, the second half of the 20th century, most of that crop was picked by migrant farm workers from Central and South America who were, in many cases, undocumented, and in all cases, basically labored in obscurity in conditions that were somewhere between indentured servitude and actual slavery, right? And it wasn't until the early 1990s that some of these tomato pickers, many of them illiterate and unconnected to power in any way, decided that they had to do something. And they decided to undertake that magic act of organizing. And a few of them started meeting at church after their work shifts and started meeting in their dormitories and started deciding, okay, we've got to do something here. And they organized some strikes, which got them some initial concessions like heat shelters and so forth. And then with that initial taste of success, they're like, hey, if we keep organizing, we can get more, right? And then they organized and started pressuring for slightly better wages. And then they realized, hey, we can't do this alone. And they started reaching out for allies in the faith community nearby, in the local media. Then they got connected to people who were labor organizers. And now all of a sudden they realized another layer of literacy and power, that their oppressors, the growers, who were paying them near slavery wages, as evil as they were, they weren't even the main problem. The main problem was the buyers, right? The fast food chains, the supermarkets, who were applying incredibly scaled pressure on those growers to drive wages down toward zero, right? And so these tomato pickers, again, now with a web of allies, started organizing and started applying shame and social norms pressure and people power and media power against the buyers. And enough of that happened where they got the buyers to actually abide by a fair food code, yeah. Right? All this unfolded over a short number of years in which people who had literally been physically, sexually, emotionally abused in obscurity now were physically, politically, economically, civically empowered, right? And I open the book with that story because it's pretty hard in modern day America to find a group of people with a lower starting level of power, mm-hmm. Right? It's pretty hard to find a group of people to whom you would say, I can find somebody more screwed than you are, right? Mm-hmm. And yet they did it. And the answer to me, the lesson is, if they could do it, there's pretty much no reason why those of us, and let's be candid, we are a very privileged group here, right? I don't know what we are economically, demographically, but just the fact that we're here on a Tuesday night means we have all kinds of piles of social capital and power and so forth. And so if they could do it, we certainly can too. And that, they give me hope, right? And the fact that we live in an age right now where now the coalition of Immokalee workers is teaching other workers all in other sectors, guest workers and others who are abused and exploited, how to organize and how to push back, and how this is spreading all around the country. This is a time of that great pushback. And I think that, it's a great time. It's a great time to be alive in civic life.
Let's go to the next question.
Hi, Eric. Thank you for coming. Last night I happened to watch a somewhat, I don't know if disturbing is the correct word, but just to keep my question short. She basically was blaming the media for Charlottesville. And it just made me think, after the election, there was a lot of... we saw a lot of opinions in the media between Middle America and those on the outsides or the outskirts of America. And how do we shape the opinions of the public with the media? Because the media is basically shaping the news that people are hearing, and certain people are hearing one aspect and other people are hearing another. And how do we, people who aren't as educated to listen to outside sources, how do we help shape their opinions?
I understand the sentiment behind the question. I would invite you to kind of reframe it a bit, because if we take as our charge, we have to educate benighted people who are not seeing the real stuff, we're not going to make enough progress with them, right? I think that one of the things that we have to recognize is that, frankly, it's among the left, the educated affluent left as well, that the tendency to fall into what others have called filter bubbles is increasingly prevalent, right? And so I think one of the things that all of us have to practice, I guess I would say my general thing is, it's less about shaping other people's thinking and more about setting an example and creating conversations that begin with questions rather than with declarative statements, right? So by example, what I mean is this. I think everybody in this room who, you know, I would bet, just because we're in San Francisco, that the great majority of people in this room consider themselves left of center. I would bet that for most of you who do consider yourselves left of center, your reading material, your sources of information and opinion are also predominantly left of center, right? The most basic thing we have a responsibility to do is to diversify our diet, right? In civic life, as it is in food and the body, like, you know, a diet that's all one thing is not good for you, right? And I think we have to set an example of understanding and hearing and really getting in the heads of people who see the world differently. Not because we expect to have our minds changed all the time, but because it is very useful and important to actually be able to unpack this. One of the projects that we're running out of the Aspen Institute is a project that we've just launched with an organization that's represented here today called Facing History in Ourselves. And it's a project called the Better Arguments Project. This project grew out of a piece that I wrote right before the election when it looked like Trump was going to lose. And it looked like, in all the kind of commentary in the mainstream elite media was, oh, after the election, how are we going to bring all of these disaffected Trump voters back into the fold and really try to help them and understand them and reconcile with them, right? And I wrote this piece that said, you know, I don't know who's going to win the election, but however it goes, I don't want to rush to a false reconciliation, right? What the election exposed was that there are these deep, deep divides, not only of philosophy and ideology, but of aspiration and cynicism and life experience, right? And that there are people literally living in different countries right now, right? And that I'd far rather actually spend time after the election reckoning with that, right? And that, again, now we're talking about Charlottesville and Confederate monuments. One of the lessons of the years right after the Civil War was that sometimes a rush to reunion is used by people who have a combined interest in keeping other folks down, mm-hmm. right? The rush to reunion in the years after Reconstruction was white reunion. It was whites from the North and South saying, hey, let's get along again, because we do agree fundamentally that blacks aren't really first-class citizens, right? Let's kind of re-honor our Confederate brethren. Let's re-honor them. And let's kind of, enough of this stuff about Reconstruction and freedmen's bureaus and reparations. Like, come on, let's move on, right? And so I'm not about rushing to reunion. I think that what we've got to do in engaging folks who have very sharply differing worldviews, whether they are in the middle of the country or right here in Central California or right here, you know, probably 15 miles from here, right, is be grown-ups. And what grown-ups do is they don't avoid the hard arguments. I think what we need in American civic life isn't fewer arguments. It's just that we need less stupid arguments, right? And that means saying, let's have better arguments. Let's actually ground our conversations in an understanding of the reality that in American civic life, we've always been, from before the founding, been fighting about basically the same five or six things over and over again, right? Any of you are fans of the musical Hamilton? We've been fighting about a Hamilton view of strong central government versus a Jefferson view of strong local control. We've been fighting about color blindness versus color consciousness. We've been fighting about liberty as our prime thing, or is it equality as our prime thing, right? Because liberty and equality run up against each other, right? We've been having these fights, whether it was about the Bank of the United States, whether it was about how to do Reconstruction, whether it was about the New Deal, whether it's about Medicare, whether it's about the Affordable Care Act, right? And so being able to situate our history and our current arguments with some sense of context, which is both about, hey, what do other folks read and think? And how do they approach these core American arguments? And how could I learn to argue their side of it, right? Now, some of you may think, you know, I don't have enough time or energy to empathize with those idiots who voted for Donald Trump. I don't have enough time to try to get in their heads and dignify their ideology with this notion that, you know, they might have a deep philosophical principled reason for voting the way they did. And I would say to you, look, this goes back to the thing about setting an example, right? If that's the example you want to set, then you will get the politics we are getting right now.
Yeah,
right? Someone has to break that cycle. And, you know, if the benefit of us being relatively educated, relatively aware of history and the world, if the benefit and burden of that is that we lead by example and try to understand the other side, then that's what it means right now for me to show up as a citizen.
Eric, in the book, you had a moment where you talked about passing a billboard when you were in traffic that mm-hmm. said, you aren't stuck in traffic, you are the traffic. And I love that because, you know, it's like, who am I to be talking about these other people and their views and how they're so closed-minded? And all they do is get their news from, actually, I get my...
I got to sell you a book that's not mine. I got to tell you all to get this book by a guy named C. Terry Warner, who is a retired professor of psychology at BYU. And he wrote a book about 15 years ago called Bonds That Make Us Free. And he describes this dynamic, this human cycle that he calls a cycle of collusion that unfolds at every scale of human life, whether it's with your partner, your friends, your neighbors, your fellow citizens in a community, you know, as between racial or demographic groups, Israelis, Palestinians, all the same cycle, which goes like this. I accuse you to excuse me, right? And so, like, in everyday life, say to my wife, hey, you didn't do the dishes, and right? To which her immediate response is, well, you didn't take out the garbage.
Do you really say that to your wife?
Well, now that we've talked about it, we don't do that. But,
I don't.
But pretty much every other... pretty much all the time, we are catching ourselves falling into these accuse-to-excuse loops, right? And what is Twitter right now but a massive loop of accuse-to-excuse, right? Yeah. What is the thing about, Confederate monuments and Charlottesville and, you know... Well, there's violence on many sides.
Yeah.
There's, you know, like, no, somebody... And what C. Terry Warner's core insight is, the only way you break that cycle is to break that cycle. It's to be the one who says, okay, goddammit, I'm going to be the one to take responsibility, right? Yeah. You're right, I didn't do the dishes. Which then creates space for her to say, you know what, I didn't take out the trash. Okay, let's do our thing now, right? But if you get into this other cycle of blaming and accusation and responsibility shirking, you get precisely the politics we have today. Right. What I think is possible is a politics of responsibility taking. And I really want to emphasize this, right? Like, this sounds so obvious, but try it. Try it for a week. Try practicing relentless responsibility taking in personal life, in civic life, in political life. It's super hard.
I'm
right?
taking the opposite lesson because I do the dishes. I take out the garbage. I do the laundry.
It's time for you to change the game, man.
I'm very grateful because I'm here tonight, and guess who's doing all that?
Yeah,
stuff
that's right.
So let's go to the next question.
All right, thank you, Eric and Abdi, for such a lively discussion. In the section, Eric, when you talk about the three I's. Integrity, inclusion, interest. I find that quite interesting, especially the last part, which is the power is assumed to be finite and zero sum, which Abdi brought it up. And then you said that the solution is you must change the equation. Well, naturally, you discuss within the United States how that can be discussed and addressed. I'd like to see if you can elaborate this further internationally, especially among various countries that...
So let's take that question.
United States bullying weaker countries. Yeah.
So I'm going to hold you there because we only have time for one more question after yours. So where do you go internationally?
Okay, Eric? Let me speak to that. But then maybe for this one more, if maybe we would hear quickly from a few and of your last questions, and then I can try to give an omnibus answer at the end here.
Marissa just shook her head.
Okay.
We'll take one question in a moment.
Okay, so here's the thing. This great pushback that I described is, of course, not just, in fact, not even primarily within the borders of the United States, right? It is the story of the Arab Spring. It is the story of the Umbrella Revolution. It is the story of the Maidan Revolution. It's the story of the Green and the Orange Revolutions. It is the story of all of these movements right now that are afoot around the world. And I think this way in which, I mean, let's take one country that is not even so much on the radar screen of most Americans, maybe those of us who are West Coasters pay a bit more attention, South Korea, right? I don't think most Americans realize that the scale of millions of South Koreans who showed up in giant marches and protests to oust a corrupt president, right? That wasn't even on our radar screen here in the United States, right? But they completely changed the equation of a politics in South Korea that had been concentrated in the hands of a few industrial conglomerates and their allies and cronies, right? And you have this kind of surge. It's actually, it's interesting. The first translated edition of this book is in Korean. Wow. Because I think of this kind of heat that's on the street right now, right? But all around the world, I think we're seeing this. And but all around the world too, including here right now, is an important pivot that people haven't fully made, which is how do you pivot from protest to durable power, right? It is one thing, you know, it's hard right now, but we will knock down the Confederate monuments of this country, right? That's one thing to do. But how then do you actually dismantle white supremacy? How then do you actually get folks to embrace deep inclusion in a society, right? How do you do that institutionally? Like that's the harder stuff that we've got to make. And this is why the Arab Spring didn't bear fruit ultimately, right? It was one thing to topple a dictator. It was another thing in a field that was essentially barren of any kind of prior habits or history of self-government to then actually build something affirmatively, right? We, again, are blessed. We have a deep... Maybe it's thinner today than it used to be, but we have a deep layer of topsoil of habits of how to run things ourselves, how to govern ourselves, right? And we'd better not let that just blow away and waste away. And I think lessons from around the world really underscore that for us.
So let's take the last question.
Hi, Eric. Thank you. My name is Lawrence. I'm very interested in switching the narrative from a broken, ineffective government to a responsive and caring government. And I work closely with agencies around... programs like participatory budgeting and civic user testing that are at the interface of citizen power and governance process. So I'm wondering what models that you have for participatory process that we can advocate for outside of the ballot box.
And Eric, so, let's give one example for where we are.
Yeah, I'm sorry. You wind me up and I get going on this stuff. So actually, you mentioned it in your question, and I bet most people in the room don't know what it is. Participatory budgeting. Right. So this is a movement that started in Brazil and has spread now to cities all around the world and in a bunch of cities now in the United States, in which the idea is simple. Municipalities carve out a chunk of their city budget, and instead of having city elected officials and their staff decide how it's going to be allocated and appropriated, they open up that pot of money to citizens to decide. Right. So in Seattle, where it's been playing out, you know, one flavor in Seattle has been for youth to do it. There's a pot of money that's dedicated to youth programs, and they've actually, it's upwards of $1 million now every year, let young people, a commission of young people, decide how they're going to spend that. Right. When you decide, when you are a decider, again, who decides? When you are both invited and obligated to be part of that process, you can't demonize the policymakers. You can't just throw pot shots. You can't complain about stuff. You're responsible, right? And you begin to see in a different way what the trade-offs are, how hard it is, how choices and priorities have to be set, and how you have to persuade other people to be on side with you, and how you have to do citizenship and politics, right? Participatory budgeting is a movement that I think has incredible promise because it gives us the sense that government is not them, it is not that thing over there. It's us not only in the sense that we are taxpayers, but it's us in that we are deciders, mm-hmm. right? And this, again, works best at the local, even hyper-local scale, getting that practice of how you actually do this stuff in a way that builds citizen muscle. And I guarantee every young person in Seattle and in other cities, New York and different California cities, they do it with different constituencies and demographics. Everybody who's participated in participatory budgeting comes out not just knowing about budgets and how to spend money. They come out knowing how to do democracy,
yeah.
right? And they become nodes of contagion, getting their parents to start showing up at school board meetings, getting their neighbors to start caring about the fact that no one's been fixing the water problem or the streetlight problem in their block. And that kind of contagion coming out of a participatory process like that is, again, yeah. something to give us some hope for the future.
And the book really lays out a number of those examples, and Citizen University itself, this is what you do, which yeah. is terrific. So I'd encourage people to learn about your organization. So we're now coming to the close, and we're going to close with the Inforum tradition here at the Commonwealth Club, which is for you to answer the following question. What is your 60-second idea, Eric, to change the world?
Show up locally. Show up locally. I think picking an issue and saying, for the next 3, 6, 9, 12 months, I'm going to go deep on this issue locally, right? It could be criminal justice reform or policing reform. It could be sustainability, whatever it is. I'm going to go deep. I'm going to learn the substance of it, the policy of it. I'm going to learn who the deciders are. I'm going to read the map of power. I'm going to figure out how to get other folks engaged in this. And when you go deep on something like that, that you touch and feel and impacts your life and the life of your neighbors, it's sort of like with participatory budgeting. Like, after you have that experience of X number of months doing that, you're ready to go. You're ready to be wound up and deployed on other issues in other places now, right? That is way more, I think, effective and useful right now than only kind of sending our emails to our senators and our members of Congress. Practice power locally.
So with that, let's close by giving a big round of applause to Eric Liu. And Eric will now be signing copies of his book outside, You're More Powerful Than You Think. Thank you all for being here tonight.
Thank you.